I teach middle school by day, and by night, I'm a preacher. I teach middle school, sixth grade currently. I used to teach sixth through eighth. We looped, and that was a beautiful system. But currently, I teach sixth grade in an eighth grade section. I teach history.
Quarterly, I preach at a Bryn Zion Welsh Church, which is a church that is established to maintain the Welsh tradition in the U.S., in the Oregon area, and also, obviously, to worship. But and I pulpit supply from time to time. But racism really is an issue of my passion. I kind of explained to the people on Monday how I came to this point. I'm not going to go into all of that now, but just to suffice it to say that my life has led in me in many ways to address this issue and to become an anti-racist, as I said in the prayer, but also a change agent. So perhaps this is your first step to becoming a change agent yourself. Maybe you're well along on the journey, but I just want to welcome you all, whatever stage you're at, and invite you to participate as the Spirit leads. Fear not, that's our theme for the summer. Last time we began with an understanding about why it's so hard for white people to talk about racism. We talked about something called white privilege, and I used a review in the New Yorker of a book by Robin DiAngelo called White Racism, White Fragility. And so white fragility is something that often keeps us from getting at this issue. I also have an article I did not share with you, but feel free to take it. There's about 50 copies. If you wish to know more about this concept of white fragility and why it makes us so reticent to talk about issues of racism, feel free. That'll be right up here. And of course, I've got some other books up here. Those small smattering of things that are on my reading list, and I'm sure many of you have been reading books like this, otherwise you wouldn't be here, perhaps. We also defined race, racism, prejudice, and discrimination. We examined three types of racism: personal, institutional, and cultural. And we're going to kind of take that to the next level today. We'll look at a 530-year-long history of the development of race, the construction of race, and racism itself. We'll delve into what white culture is and how it controls society if we get that far. I don't know if we will. We'll take a break also in about the hour point to kind of get you, let you stand up, go to the bathroom, leave if you need to. It's really okay. This is a tough issue, and we kind of got at some of those words when I put up a sentence that says, when I talk about racism, I feel blank because blank. That's the way we started off the last session, and there were some challenging words there. Many of the words were words like hopeless or guilty. Some people said hopeful. That's great. I got some other book recommendations here. These just came out this year. So you want to talk about race, Ijeoma Aluo is becoming a more voluble voice in the race understanding topic.
Seattle author, too.
I'm sorry?
She's a Seattle author.
Oh, Seattle. I did not know.
Yeah.
Thank you. White Fragility, Why It's So Hard for White People to Talk About Race. Robin DiAngelo has been in this for quite some time. A white woman. So those are two books that have just come out this year. All right. I showed this image on Monday because oftentimes it's easy for us to think about racism and think about the personal and the individual relationships that we have and not consider ourselves racists because I treat people with kindness. I don't use words and language that put people down. But when we start to look at the institutional and cultural aspects of racism, we then start to understand and recognize that we participate in a system, even if we don't act on a daily basis, speak words on a daily basis that put down, we participate in a system that's been ongoing for some time. So one can actually be kind to another person of color. Person of color can be kind to a white person. But we all participate in a system that perpetuates racism. Okay. we'll more into that later. And I know we talked a lot about definitions before. We kind of got a little bit, we spent a lot of time on this, would it be fair to say, on definitions? And I don't mean to bog down on it again, but I do want to bring up the definition I had come up with before: personal, institutional, and cultural structures that reinforce the idea that people with one set of characteristics are superior to people with a different set of characteristics. A lot of language. Some people have told me, well, why don't you just tighten that up? So there's the tighter version. And perhaps you've heard racism equals prejudice plus power, but I put that word systemic in there because I think it's important to think about not just within a localized context, because you brought up the context of Detroit, and it got me to thinking about what is it? What's the context that we're talking about? I want to keep this conversation broad. I want to keep us thinking about North America and possibly even the world, and who is in power. What structures, what systems are in power on a worldwide scale, and certainly on a North American scale. So I was thinking about that Detroit example. Although the example on Monday was brought up that a person can walk, has walked into a situation where they are white, and they are told, well, I don't serve you because you're white. And that may happen in a few places in the country. I'm not certainly not denying that. It may happen in Detroit, it may happen in other places. Another person brought that example up of another place that it happened in the United States. But it is not the overarching experience of white people. They can leave Detroit, they then can go to another place, and it doesn't happen in most places. So if in one situation color benefits African Americans, in by far and away most places in the country, it does not. So the freedom that white people have to not experience racism is greater. So that's the definition that I'll continue to use. And then we talked, people were shooting out this term. This term, microaggression, has been around since the 1970s. Can someone read the definition? It's just the one-liner, microaggression.
Subtle verbal and nonverbal put-downs.
Yeah. How many of you are familiar with this term, microaggressions? Okay, it started to filter into the English language. But I just wanted to make sure that we're all on the same page regarding what it is. There's actually three types of microaggressions. Microassaults, deliberate and overt comments and actions that serve to put people down. And I think maybe I don't need to explain this one, but epithets and calling someone from Asia an Oriental or a white person cracker, that kind of thing is, that's microassault. Calling a person of color, a black person, the N-word. Micro-insult are unconscious communications that demean. So these are I'll go to the school curriculum. If the curriculum only teaches about a certain cross-section of people, that is microaggression. Even if it happens throughout the year, it's unspoken. It's perhaps unconscious, or you're looking at your students out there and you don't even know you're calling on a certain set of students, a certain subset of students. That's unconscious, but it is communication. It's communicating to something to the students of color in your classroom. Maybe what's on the walls of the classroom is also communicating something to the students in the classroom. Maybe there's a picture of Thomas Jefferson over there, George Washington, and Abraham Lincoln over there, but there really isn't a picture of Booker T. Washington or a picture of Maya Angelou. So that communicates, and that's kind of on the micro-insult level. Micro-invalidation is minimizing the thoughts and feelings of a person of color. And what I'm talking about there is someone might say something, a person of color might say something in my classroom, and I might say, Anybody else think something about this topic? That might be a micro invalidation. I want to recommend this book. Has anybody read this by by Claudia Rankine, Citizen. It's a book of poetry. If you love poetry, this book is for you. Let me go a little bit deeper into microaggressions here. And she tells just little vignettes, little stories in poetic form. When a woman you work with calls you by the name of another woman you work with, it is too much of a cliche not to laugh out loud with the friend beside you who says, "Oh no, she didn't." Still, in the end, so what? Who cares? She had a 50-50 chance of getting it right. Yes, and in your mail, the apology note appears referring to our mistake. Apparently, your own invisibility is the real problem causing her confusion. This is how the apparatus she propels you into begins by multiplying its meaning. What did you say? You catch what's going on there? It's a little bit... I mean, she's poetic at it, but she's an African-American woman who is one of two African-Americans who work in a business, and someone calls her by the name of the other African-American woman. It's like, it brings out the sense of invisibility that so often accompanies a person of color in our culture. Like, oh yeah, I didn't recognize you there. That I'm sorry, I thought you were somebody else. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. Here's another one. At the end of a brief phone conversation, you tell the manager you are speaking with that you will come by his office to sign the form. When you arrive and announce yourself, he blurts out, "Oh, I didn't know you were black." "Oh, I didn't mean to say that," he then says. Aloud, you say, "What?" he asks. "You didn't mean to say that aloud." Your transaction goes swiftly after that. So this would fall into the category of microaggression. We might spend a little bit more time with Claudia, with Dr. Rankine. Okay. All right, here's another one, and some of you have seen this if you were part of the workshops of last year. Identify the microaggressions.
So we turn out the light.
If you need to turn out the lights in order to see it, by all means.
Hi there.
Hi.
Nice day, huh?
Yeah, finally, right?
Where are you from? Your English is perfect.
San Diego. We speak English there.
Oh, no. Where are you from?
Born in Orange County, but I never actually lived there.
I mean before that.
Before I was born.
Well, where are your people from?
Well, my great-grandma was from Seoul.
Korean. I knew it. I was like, she's either Japanese or Korean. But I was leaning more towards Korean.
Amazing.
That's good. There's a really good teriyaki barbecue place in my apartment. So I actually really like kimchi.
Cool. What about you? Where are you from?
San Francisco.
But where are you from?
Oh, I'm so cool.
Really? You're Native American?
No. Native American. Oh, well, I guess my grandparents are from England.
Oh, well... On the camp, we will drop the river. Bloody hell! I think your people's fish and chips are amazing.
You're weird.
Really? Weird? Must be a Korean thing.
Thank you.
We'll leave the lights off for now because there's actually a trailer here I should show you. But what are some of the comments that were microaggressive?
Every single one of them.
Every single one of them. Well, identify them.
Where are your people from?
Right, exactly. Just by the way that they articulate and make sure that you get every word.
He likes kimchi.
He likes kimchi. I really like kimchi.
Oh my gosh. He's a real American.
I'm just regular American. Yeah. I think you got the idea. And what do they communicate? Now that you've identified the actual words, what do those words communicate?
I belong, but you don't.
Mm-hmm. The meeting.
I'm sorry?
It's the meeting.
A meeting?
Demeaning.
A meaning.
Yeah,
demeaning. Demeaning. Well, okay. How do they demean?
Just by the whole attitude.
Like maybe you're not.
Talking down.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I'm legitimate, you're not.
Yeah, I'm legitimate and you're not.
Or that the norm in America is white and everybody else is like from somewhere else.
Right, exactly.
He was tokenizing her too, kind of fitting her into a box.
Yeah, you're right. And what's he doing when he says, I really like kimchi. I really can relate to your culture. I really like your culture. I think that's what he's probably thinking in his head, but what's actually happening?
He's trying to appropriate her culture.
He show her how aware he is of her culture.
I thought she was coming. Go ahead and say.
Even though she's the outsider, I really understand your people. You know, yeah.
Well, it could be even more insulting by comparing Japanese and Korean cultures.
Yeah.
I mean, the Japanese oppressed the Koreans for so long.
Yeah.
It's like, dude, shut the hell up.
I know. And you get the impression that he's waiting for her to be impressed. Like,
yeah.
Like she says, soul. Oh, I know where soul is. Of course.
Yeah. Not the worst pickup I've ever seen.
I know. Yeah. So, you know, you can feel the sphincters. When you see this, and it's exaggerated, but perhaps you've seen this kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, just the fact that he's dragging her into this conversation, I mean, she wouldn't do the same back again. She did, to point it out, but I mean, she wouldn't, you know, if she had come across him, it's hard to imagine she would have gotten into this whole, oh, where are you from? Where are you born? Where are you from?
That's right.
You know, but he can get away with it.
Yeah. You know what's also interesting about this interaction that I wanted to point out was like, can I have a volunteer up here? Just stand right here. Somebody from the front row.
The birthday girl right here.
All right, birthday. Happy birthday. All right. So this won't hurt a bit. So, you know, I'm walking along and I'm punching. And I'm walking along and I'm punching again. And I'm walking along, I punch. You know, now how's that feeling?
Okay.
So imagine a person of color getting one of those little micro punches every time someone walks by, and then that guy walks by. What's going to be your reaction? Like the 100th time it happens. And what's the one person who's the 100th punch? You can sit down now. Thanks for your time. I hope you're going to do okay. What's the 100th person who makes those comments going to feel if they get a blow up?
What did I know? Why are they so sensitive?
They take it so personally. Like, I didn't mean to say that to you. Why are you getting all sensitive about this? You know?
You're overreacting. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, and white people don't get this. Maybe we get punched once. Okay. You want to see the trailer?
Yeah.
It's fun.
Fish and chips. Pheasants. Butter cream, bangers and mash, Guinness, put on some lunch, a spot of tea, a pint of ale.
Someone hit the lights. I showed this because it's
okay. It must have been the producer.
Yeah, yeah,
yes.
It was. Yeah, that's the guy. So I show this because it's humorous, and it kind of gets the conversation flowing. But the American Psychiatric Association prescribes three kind of steps, if you want to think of three, to kind of how to respond to microaggressions. And assess your situation, make sure you're safe. Just make sure that if you respond to somebody, if that woman were to respond to that man, she wants to be safe in that situation. Take a breath, don't react immediately. Not sure she did that, but she was kind of cornered. And then model the behavior that you want to see from the other person. Now, if you want the other person to say, a pint of ale, a spalteen, then feel free to say those kinds of things. But maybe maybe you want to model a different way of behaving. Avoid being sarcastic. She didn't do that real well, but remember that the goal is to educate and not to humiliate. And then third, focus on the event and not the person. And in any kind of debate, it just devolves into a chaotic mess when you start to focus on the person rather than the issue itself. So there's your 3-point. What to do in a microaggression? Has anybody ever experienced a microaggression in here? Any kind?
Well, I think women experience that all the time.
Yeah.
You know, you're talked down to, or you're minimized, or you're not included in a conversation, or, you know, it's just part of being how we are in the world.
I think we all do it.
Good point.
I think all of us are guilty of doing it,
yeah,
too.
Probably.
If anyone in here is thinking they haven't done this, I don't think they're being honest. We all
thank you.
Do things like this.
Yeah.
And I think this brings it to our attention, but we've all done things. So.
Young people experience a lot of ageism in this community.
Yeah.
Young people experience a lot of ageism.
Like
church settings.
Like in the situation, like, oh, you're young, you don't know anything.
Yeah,
or you're just a kid.
Like, well, why would you ask him to leave? Why would you ever be in that position of power? You don't have the experience, the education.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Dennis.
It seems to be this response, though, is how do you respond if you're the target of a microaggression? But I think as people of privilege, we need to be thinking about how do we respond when we see microaggressions?
Yeah. How do you walk?
Is it that the person who experiences it is always the person who has to point it out? Do we not have an obligation to call ourselves and our neighbors on these things?
Yeah. Tomorrow is my last session of this 3-day, and it'll be more focused on empowering you and giving you a structure to think about what to do. I'm not necessarily going to lay out what you do aside from this necessarily, but you're going to have time tomorrow if you come back to think about what do you do in a microaggression? How do you use your white power to intervene and not just be a bystander, not just be somebody standing off to the side watching it happen and saying nothing? We have power in this culture, and we need to use it.
Right.
Yeah, go.
We also need to use it the safe way.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
You bet.
You're from Portland, so you are familiar with the experience on Mass, where two people stood up to defend, and one of them, or three, two of them got killed.
All three were stabbed about a year ago. It's actually about 4 blocks away from our house, interestingly. I mean, I don't mean to show off in any way. This is, I can tell you lots of stories, but, you know, I'm a facilitator. I'm supposed to look competent and all that. But I have plenty of stories where I did not step in, but I have one story where I actually did. And it was in Milwaukee, Oregon, when I was standing at a gas station. My apologies.
I'll use closer.
I was standing at a gas station in Milwaukee, Oregon, and the person in front of me was clearly someone not from the United States and did not speak English quite as well as I do. If I can be so presumptuous as to say I speak English well. But I was struggling to kind of get the right amount of change back from the teller. And the person, that was the person two in front of me. Then the person in front of me turns to me
behind him, as if I'm going to be his ally in this. He says, I hate effing, and he didn't use the word effing. I hate effing foreigners.
Oh,
and so,
right?
Well, I mean, he was staying a foot away from him. He was kind of looking at me and kind of hoping I would say, yeah, I do too, you know? How tempting would that have been for some? But I just said, you know, we don't say that in our country. We don't believe that in this country. It was the one moment of, like, I was present. I had just gone through a training, and, you know, I had some thoughts in my head. I had some craziness, and I'm like, we don't say that in our country. That's not appropriate. And he kind of looked at me like... And that is the thing about being an anti-racist, if you will, a change agent. Because, and I'm going to, you know, some of you know Jamie Schilling. She just left on the bus today. And she gave me a wonderful image of what race and racism is like in this country. Imagine you're in the airport and you're walking down that conveyor belt carrying all your luggage, your baggage. You're carrying your luggage with you down that conveyor belt, and you can do one of three things. You can stand on the conveyor belt, just stand there, and imagine that the conveyor belt is the stream of racism that goes through our country, our culture. You can stand there and do nothing. You just go with the flow. Or you can actually physically walk this way and even go farther on it, like help it along. Or you can try to walk the opposite direction. And when you walk the opposite direction, what happens? You might run into some people, you might bump heads with some people, people kind of look at you strange, like, why are you walking the opposite direction on the conveyor belt? And so when you start to do this kind of work, you run counter, it's countercultural. It is countercultural because the guy was looking for sympathy from me. He was looking for, like, community. He was looking for, like, you're my bud. You're my guy. I can relate to you, right? And when he didn't, and when I didn't relate to him, it's like there's a separation that happens, and I distance myself. We all want to be in community. We all want to be in that space where people like us, and we're with people who like us and all that, but then you distance yourself. And I also wasn't with that guy who was in the front, who was having a heck of a time getting through his transaction with the teller. You know, he probably has had a lot of experiences with white people in our culture that put him... that made him distrust me. So, A, I don't have the trust of the person two people ahead of me, and I just lost the trust of the person next to me. So I'm just kind of out here in no man's land, no person's land, if you will. It's a slog. Anti-racism work is a slog, and it's lonely. So there's just a warning. Yeah.
I would suggest that you had that rejoinder that might have had some effect prior to January of 2017. If you tried it now, today, you might get other people chiming the exact opposite in. That, in fact, in the United States now, it is quite permissible to express racist views. A lot of people who have held that in suppression have been held in suppression by being polite and politically correct and that sort of thing, have now been freed up to express their resentment or aggression towards anybody of a different race or color.
What I really like about your comment is that it recognizes that racism has been around for a long time, and there have been moments of permissiveness and less permissiveness, but right now we appear to be in a time when it's more permissive to be outward, overtly microaggressive or racist. Thank you for bringing that up.
That is, if you accept that standard, you know, just because a certain group is in power doesn't necessarily mean that's going to be the standard from now on.
Mm-hmm.
It's only the standard if you accept that as the standard.
Right. Correct.
I still have my standards, and they're completely different, and I don't accept these, you know, isms as the norm, or there might be some power with that at the moment to various degrees, but I don't believe that's going to be the standard that most folks are set in.
And Newton said, you know, for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. For every movement, a social movement, there's arguably an equal and opposite anti-movement. Think about the Reformation and the Counter-Reformation that took place after that.
so often, or the women's movement, and then there was kind of a counter movement against that took place. Don't despair, but maybe we're just in that pendulum swing and we just have to trust God, fear not, and continue on the way we believe that we should be, that God has called us to be. Awesome point. Hey, I also want to say, just kind of be transparent here a little bit. I said at the last session on Monday that if I were to critique my session right now, the first critique I would give was that I'm doing this class alone, by myself, with my one single perspective, my white, male, privileged, able-bodied, English-speaking, heterosexual, vegetarian perspective.
But you just nullified it.
If I had my choice, and I tried, I would have another person next to me who could kind of check me and make sure that I've got another perspective up here. So thank you for chiming in. I also want to thank those of you who are here, and you're here for a reason. You came to this room, maybe you've got a lot of knowledge behind you, and I thank you for being here. If much of what I say is you're agreeing with, awesome. If some of what I say you disagree with, thank you for being here. If what I say you disagree with, and you speak up against what I'm saying, you get a double thanks for being here and for having the courage to speak up. So thank you. Okay. So we had agreements last time. Stay engaged. Speak your truth responsibly. Listen to understand rather than be understood. Be willing to do things differently and experience some discomfort. We went into that with regard to white fragility last time. We white people are just not used to talking about racism, and when we start to feel a little uncomfortable about this, we can just go that way and just not talk about it. We don't have to talk about it. So I thank you for being in this room and for choosing to feel some discomfort. Expect and accept non-closure. I'm not going to answer all your questions, and we're certainly not going to resolve this issue tonight. We're going to pose some. We're going to look at a timeline today, and we're going to see where the problem has arisen, how the problem has arisen, and we're going to get at some nuances in that. But tomorrow really is the day where you're going to get the time to and have time, the structure to come up with something to take away. So. Be patient, and then be confidential. If you talk about this workshop outside of this class, awesome. But don't say, Susan, she said this, and I can't believe she said that. That was just the most... Anyway, just speak your truth. Speak the truth that you have, but let other people speak their truth. Certainly talk about the issues we've talked about. Certainly talk about the challenges you feel, but let other people talk about the challenges they experience. All right? Now, that's going to come out terribly on the recording. Jonah, if you're hearing me, just edit this part out. Oh my goodness. I need help! All right. Well, so what I want to do is begin a 500-year, about 530-year long history of racism, the deconstruction of race, and how racism has unfolded over the last 528 years. I'm starting with 1492, but I'll have to. Really, the seed of where I believe race and race understanding began was when Europe began to explore the rest of the world. You may remember, you don't remember, but in 1347 to 1351, Europe experienced a cataclysmic event. Do you know what it was?
Plague.
The bubonic plague, precisely. And it wiped out a quarter of Europe. 75 million Europeans died. And that allowed, actually, interestingly, many of those people who were in serfs on feudal manors to rise up out of that, because then they became more valuable, a more valuable part of the economic system.
so they could demand for more for their labor because there was fewer of them. It's just law of supply and demand. As that happened, they tend to move into urban areas, and then they became merchants and business people, and then they were starting to look for the markets. Where should we place the goods? We don't have enough markets to bring all our goods to here in Europe, so they started to look outside of Europe for new markets. And so they started to explore part of the world. This is just kind of like the foundation of this age we call the Age of Exploration. It's what brought Hernan Cortes to the Central America. It's what brought Vasquez and all those other people, De Soto, to different parts of the world to see who else they could trade with. And they came with an understanding, however, as they went out to different parts of the world, they didn't necessarily come out, they didn't watch a lot of Star Trek back then. They didn't have an understanding of non-interference. I'll just betray my Trekkiness here. But they more had an idea of, I'm going out in order to gain glory. If I'm a conquistador or someone else who can conquer, I am doing this for the glory of God, and I want the gold. So they were looking for money, they were looking for glory, and they were looking this to do this for the glory of God, to take the word of God out and turn anybody into a Christian that they could. Well, this was the understanding. And it got so, and I would contend that Europeans really didn't understand their race. They just saw themselves as people. But as they moved out into the rest of the world, they met people of different skin color, and they thought, we're different. So I guess we're better, because we know ourselves and we are more powerful militarily and can conquer you, and which is what in most cases they did. So with that little beginning, let's go ahead and look at the timeline. You see it on the walls. Susan and I put these up right before this session. And we'll use this timeline for an activity I want to do tomorrow. A history of racism. This much of this material comes from a resource called Dismantling Racism. It's a wealth of resources on the internet. Just type in Dismantling Racism, and you will find all the information that you would ever want to use for workshops, for self-learning, for maybe a classroom if you want to use. There's simulations, there's readings, there's varieties of activities. It's a wealth of information. Dismantling Racism is the organization that's put this website up. So, some of this information actually comes from my own research, or I might cite the source down here, Race, the Power of an Illusion, which is a PBS resource from, I retrieved it on last year. So let's go ahead and dive into the last 530 years. The same slides that you see I'm going to show are the same ones that are on the walls right now. Ancient Greeks differentiate people of culture and language, but not by physical differences. We've had slaves for quite some time. They're mentioned in the Bible. But they are not slaves based on skin color. It's not a distinction based on white or person of color. It's largely, I might take a prisoner of war, or there might be an exchange of somehow from another family or another tribe, and there might be a chance to be set free after a time, like an indentured servant. So that's why that's the kind of slavery we largely see in Scripture, with the possible exception of when Moses and his people ask Pharaoh to be set free. Yes, that is lifetime enslavement. So we do see it from time to time in Scripture. But the kind of slavery, I was talking to a professor of African history, Stephen, if you know him from the last couple of days, he was telling me that African slavery, and there was that, was not at all the kind of slavery that became chattel slavery in this country. It was more, maybe you will take a prisoner of war and you will incorporate them into your household, and it was much more relational. And there was the understanding that those people would be set free after a while, or maybe they would marry my daughter. It wasn't at all the subservient, lifelong chattel slavery that we saw for hundreds of years in this country.
1300s, it was thought that the word slave comes from Slav, prisoners from Slavonic tribes of Europe captured by Germans, sold to Arabs during the Middle Ages. Again, it's slaves are gained through conquest, war, or debt, not because of physical characteristics. We do not have that kind of definition and category of slavery until we'll find out. I'm using the date 1492 as a general date to not just pin the blame on one single person, Christopher Columbus, but to kind of use that as a date to understand the kind of exploration that Europeans engaged in as they explored the rest of the world. Can someone read this? Maybe somebody from up close?
Before Columbus set foot on this continent, before what is known as First Contact, North America had hundreds of different indigenous cultures and almost 2,000 different languages. People had perfected the art of agriculture, were using irrigation canals, built dams, engaged in many of the same activities and agricultural advancements as peoples in Asia, Europe, and Africa. Families were matrilineal. This map produced by Aaron Carapella, which reflects the names of nations as the people in these communities named themselves.
And can I have someone read the names of these? So matrilineal, of course, means that the mother's line is the one that's followed much more than the father's line. 1492. All right. Columbus comes to the Americas in the name of Spain. He makes four voyages. First time he comes, he comes upon the natives of Hispaniola. We don't know where exactly where it is, but it's somewhere in the on the island of Haiti and that island, Dominican Republic. And the first contact was actually quite amiable, and there was much respect between the two. He leaves, and then he comes back, and it's that second voyage that really, he literally tightens the thumbscrews. He carefully documents the voyages, including directions, currents, and descriptions of the residents as ripe for subjugation. James Lowen's book, Lies My Teacher Told Me, speaks of how the race construction begins here. Maybe. With his story. He notes how the 12 high school... Oh, James Lowen is a researcher who has looked at 12 high school textbooks that are used throughout the country. And he just tracks how race is told, how the race story is told in those 12 high school textbooks, and finds them wanting, we'll just say. He notes how the 12 high school history textbooks most used in the U.S. offer a discovery narrative of an enlightened colonialism that brings the gift of civilization to the savage. This narrative ignores the ways in which Columbus truly did transform the modern world through the taking of land, etc., etc. Yes, he did take slaves. To read some of the stories about how slaves were treated when the conquistadors came to the island of Hispaniola are horrific. Putting them in mines treating them like cattle. Chattel, if you will, to the point where the people of Hispaniola say, we don't want to be treated that way. And in one dramatic point in this effort, they decide we don't want our children to be treated this way either. So they kill their children and they kill themselves so that they do not want, so that they will not experience and their children will not experience this kind of treatment. They were treated horrifically. Michel de Cuneo, who accompanied Columbus on a voyage, writes about what motivated Columbus. After we had rested for several days in our settlement, it seemed to the Lord Admiral that it was time to put into execution his desire to search for gold, which was the main reason he had started on so great a voyage. And this little note down here, Europeans did not come to the Americas by race. They came here by nationalities. They didn't understand themselves as racial beings. They understood themselves as, I'm from Sudetenland, or I'm from Normandy, or from different parts of Europe. Not necessarily of whatever color they came. They came here by nationality. A reader?
Spanish conquistadors introduced enslaved Africans to the Carolina region in order to plant and harvest indigo and rice. Black slavery isn't legally recognized until this region comes under English rule, however. The Carolina Grand Council declares slavery as a legal institution in 1669.
Okay, this is a little late, but this is not exactly the date that I want you to remember. There's an earlier date I want you to remember. We'll get back to this time frame, though. All right, 1607. A reader, please.
Jamestown, the first permanent English settlement in the Americas, is founded. Wealthy aristocrats make up most of the residents. However, they're not used to working the land, so they rely on the relatively few indentured servant commoners to farm food crops and the two main cash crops, tobacco and cotton.
There's what we can think of that Jamestown looked like. Incidentally, when Europeans first came here, the Spanish really wanted to enslave the Native Americans. And so they were the first to be attempted to be enslaved. Didn't work out for them. Native Americans, as it turns out, escaped too much down into Florida. The Seminoles, of course, that's where they're from. But they also fought back. And they also died from the diseases that the Europeans brought. So A, they resisted. B, they just died off, as they did in the millions when the Europeans brought their diseases with them. Not intentionally, but it happened. So Native Americans didn't make good slaves. When the English first arrived in America, neither the colonists nor Indians thought of themselves in either racial terms. And this is an interesting story where Protestant England's rival is Spain, while Native Americans see themselves as many nations divided by language, custom, and power. So when John Rolfe marries Pocahontas, It's a scandal in Europe, not because there's a white man who is marrying a person of color, but because Pocahontas is royalty and John Rolfe is this common. That's really what scandalizes this relationship in Europe. So we still have class going on here, not race yet. All right, another reader.
The first documented Africans arrive in an English colony named Jamestown in August 1619. A Dutch warship had captured them from the Spanish, who had enslaved them and sold them to the Virginia colonists. The 20 and odd Negroes may have been treated as indentured servants and later freed after their periods of servitude had expired.
So these 20 and odd Negroes were first brought here on a warship, by a Portuguese warship that was then traded to the English, brought not on their own volition at all, but the understanding was that they were, like the other commoners in the community, indentured servants and would eventually be free. All right. 1640. Can anyone see that to read it?
Three servants working for a farmer named Hugh Gwen run away to Maryland. One is described as a Dutchman, the other a Scotsman. The third is described as a Negro. They are captured in Maryland and returned to Jamestown, where the court sentences all three to 30 lashes, a severe punishment even by the standards of 17th century Virginia. The Dutchman and the Scotsman are sentenced to an additional year of servitude. But in addition to the whipping, the black man, named John Punch, is ordered to serve his said master or his assigns for the time of his natural life, here or elsewhere.
This is a significant date that if you're into dates, this might be an interesting one to remember. 1640, two men are, three men, exact same indentured servant situation. Then they both run away. They are all three captured. One is punished more severely than the other, and inflicted with lifelong servitude. Call it slavery, if you will. That black man is named John Punch. So possibly the construction of racism, of race, begins or leads up to this point. But 1640 is kind of a significant date. Do you feel the need to stand up? I see some of you are kind of fanning yourselves. Is it hot in here? Maybe we'll just continue. All right. 1676. In early colonial America, social identities are fluid and class distinctions trump physical ones. On Virginia plantations, Europeans, indentured servants, and African slaves live side by side and intermarry. And don't they work, they play, they interact as equals. Although there is a rebellion called Bacon's Rebellion, which unites these two groups in interesting ways and then severs them. I'm going to go a little bit more into Bacon's Rebellion here in just a moment. The rebellion is short-lived, but the outcome of Bacon's Rebellion had profound implications for the construction of race in our country. 1676. Let's take a little closer look at this, actually. And by the way, anybody remember Bacon's Rebellion from middle school? Okay, I'm going to let somebody else tell a story instead of me.
Hey, I want to talk to you about Bacon's Rebellion today, which is really one of the most important early conflicts in American history. It's going to have some very far-reaching ramifications. It all goes down in 1676 in Virginia. And remember, Virginia controlled by England at this time. England had been in control of Virginia since it first settled there, 1607 in Jamestown. So let me explain a couple groups, and then the rebellion, and then the major effect of it. So the first group you got to understand and know about the rebellion, the Tidewater Aristocrats. This picture really sums them up right here, but let's break down this term here. Tidewater, they call it Tidewater because they lived in the Tidewater region of Virginia, which was like the coastal area, close to all the little river inlets and Chesapeake area, prime real estate. Aristocrats, because they were rich, right? They lived in these big houses right here on these huge plantations, and they grew lots of tobacco, and then they would ship it back to England, make a fortune. They also control the first elected assembly, known as the House of Burgesses, the governing body of Virginia at that time, is controlled by the Tidewater aristocrats for the most part. The other group you got to understand are these guys right here, indentured servants. Zoom in here. These guys were the people who worked on the plantations of the Tidewater aristocrats. You have to understand right now that slavery is not big in the United States yet. Where did they get their labor from, these Tidewater aristocrats? These guys, indentured servants. An indentured servant was essentially a poor person from England or Scotland or some other country who, for their passage to the New World, which was paid for by the Tidewater aristocrat, would work on that Tidewater aristocrat's plantation for usually the year was the amount, it was about 7 years. But after those 7 years, they were free to go do what they want. So it's oftentimes a good way of maybe kind of starting a new life. And so now by 1676, we have a lot of indentured servants who have been free, who have worked their 7 years, and now are free in this new world to start their own life. And where do a lot of them go? Well, they can't go to the Tidewater, so they go inland. They go westward to the Blue Ridge Mountains, which is called the backcountry in Virginia, and they begin to settle their own land. And they run into a group who's living on that land. Who do those indentured servants run into? The Native Americans. And they started to have a lot of conflict with the Native Americans. And one of the guys decides, who is one of the backcountry farmers living out there, name is Nathaniel Bacon, decides, we need some help back here. And so he makes a plea to the House of Burgesses. He says, will you help us, the backcountry landowners, defeat these Native Americans out here? House of Burgesses refuses to help because what Nathaniel Bacon, this guy right here, doesn't realize, the House of Burgesses has a secret deal with the Native Americans for trade. And so Nathaniel Bacon takes his followers, and that's where you get this picture right here, and he marches to the House of Burgesses, confronts them. Well, House of Burgesses is led by this guy right here, William Burton, and says, you better help us with the Native Americans. If you don't, we're going to burn this building down. As a show of force, he goes and burns down parts of Jamestown and says, you're next. And then Nathaniel Bacon and his followers retreat, and kind of out of the blue, he ends up getting sick and dying of dysentery. And so this rebellion is essentially over. And so, a big question's been raised among the Tidewater aristocrats now. What are we going to do with these indentured servants who all of a sudden become free, but then they go looking for new land and end up causing these big conflicts like Nathaniel Bacon has just done? How can we get a form of labor in here who we don't have to set free? And so in a really indirect way, Nathaniel Bacon's rebellion leads to slavery in this new world, because these Tidewater aristocrats realize, well, every time we free these indentured servants, they go move out to the backcountry and cause a ruckus like this rebellion. Well, let's get some labor in here that we never have to free. And so the slave trade is going to take off in a very big way after Nathaniel Bacon's rebellion. 1680s, 1690s, early 1700s, the African slave trade in the Americas is going to flourish. And that is in large part because indentured servitude, in the eyes of the Tidewater aristocrats at least, has failed. And slavery becomes a lot cheaper, and you never have to free these individuals.
All right. So you've got a class forming right now. And he didn't mention at the beginning of this video that many of those indentured servants were from Africa and were freeable and were often freed. Well, one way to identify a group of people on site is through skin color. It was easy. It was readily visible. So the Africans who were already here under indentured servants auspices became that class, which was no longer free. There was no chance. 1676. Mm-hmm. Important date to remember. Mm-hmm. All right. Let's get back to our video. Okay, I am noting that the time is 6:30, and maybe I'd like to give you about 5 minutes to get up, stretch, go if you need to go. It's a little hot in here, but we've gone for about an hour. We have about 50 minutes more to go. Let's go 5 minutes and then come on back.
Not so much this, like,
Bacon's Rebellion really becomes a moment in history when there's a break. 1676 is a key point in history when a class is created in the United States based on race. Yeah.
Am I correct? I think I heard somewhere that that was the first time in literature that the word white appears?
It appears in different places. Where do you get your information?
Some workshop I went to. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But it referred to how they divided, you know, people of color from white.
I might put it to 1640, when during that John Punch incident, when John Punch is identified as black, and the other two are not identified by skin color. Okay. Probably isn't the word black. It's probably Negro is the term that they use.
But the term white is used to.
Yeah, that's a good question.
There, because it's assumed that it's normal, so you wouldn't have to put a label on it.
Right, but at some point it is used, though, to delineate between people. But I would say that it's I don't know for sure, but I would say that it was around this time, but I'd like to do some more research on that. Thank you for bringing that up. All right. 1680, early colonial laws refers to Christians as Englishmen rather than whites. Following Bacon's Rebellion, new laws begin to appear to separate black slaves from European indentured servants. So poor whites are now given new rights and opportunities, including as overseers of slaves. As the importance of slavery grows, the term white is used increasingly. So this begins to answer your question, 1680s perhaps. Legal documents and other social arenas, slavery becomes associated with blackness. Reader?
Virginia slave codes are passed. As wealthy Virginia planters continue to turn from indentured servitude towards slavery, they write laws making slavery permanent for Africans and dividing blacks from whites and slaves from free men. The rights of African Americans are increasingly curtailed, while poor whites are given new entitlements and opportunities. Over time, poor whites identify more with wealthy whites rather than their black economic peers.
And so whiteness actually becomes a sort of currency and a sort of a something that you can put into the bank in a certain sense. Even if you're poor, then you at least have your whiteness. And I'll just go ahead and say this too. Many people say, and we touched upon this last time, that, well, why shouldn't we be talking about class? What if we, shouldn't we be focused on class rather than race? And my answer to that is that race is the underlying stream that runs through our culture, and it's constantly there. There are probably very few issues that are specifically a matter of race, but all issues, because we are in a racialized society, are tinged by race. And it shows up in so many ways. Okay. The Negro Act in South Carolina was passed in response to the Stono Slave Rebellion, 1739. 50 people were killed, 25 whites, 35 to 50 slaves were killed. This was the largest slave uprising to our knowledge. There were many slave uprisings, but the Stono Slave Rebellion was the biggest. Even including Nat Turner's rebellion. Slaves outnumbered whites in the Carolinas, so a prohibitive duty was placed on slave imports to slow down the number of slaves that were imported into Carolinas. The Negro Act prevented enslaved people from growing their own food, assembling groups, earning money, and learning to write. Also, there could be no more than 10 slaves for each white person on any plantation. So, immigration laws are starting to pop up. I'm going to skip over this a little bit, move forward in the interest of time, because I want to get to this. Anybody ever heard of the Declaration of Independence? It's a well-known document among some, but the thing I find interesting, of course, and it is our perpetual conundrum, to try and figure out how certain people can advocate so strongly and so strongly for independence for themselves while completely ignoring the desire that they know is there for other people,
yeah,
for freedom. That's the paradox of how our nation became independent. And we still wrestle with it today. It's an interesting thing to note also why the Declaration of Independence was, why this independence movement started. Of course you've heard of the Sugar Act, and the Tea Act, Townsend Acts, and all that kind of stuff. All those taxes that were put onto the colonies to pay for the things that England needed more money, having just finished the French and Indian War in the 1760s, and that they needed money. Well, the colonists were a great treasure. But another reason, if they were frustrated with the taxes and no taxation without representation and all of that, the time is significant because it's around this time that England starts to question its own slavery. And so the colonists are thinking, England is going to break away from slavery. We sure don't want to do that. So why don't we become independent? And then we can do what we want. That's partly what's going on here. It's no accident that 1776 is the time frame around which we declare independence from Britain. Eventually, the British, of course, do. The House of Lords declares slavery illegal in 1834, August 1st. Happy anniversary, 1834. But the desire to start slowing down slavery in England starts right about now. Okay. Oh, what's left out of the Declaration of Independence? This was edited out of the Declaration. King George, amidst all of those grievances that Ben Franklin and, of course, the writer Thomas Jefferson want to make sure the world knows about, this was one that was left out. A reader.
King George has waged cruel war against human nature itself, violating its most sacred rights of life and liberty in the persons of a distant people who never offended him, captivating and carrying them into slavery in another hemisphere, or to incur miserable death in their transportation.
Keep going, you're doing well.
He is determined to keep an open market where men should be bought and sold. He has prostituted his negative for suppressing every legislative attempt to prohibit or to restrain this execrable commerce, and he is now exciting those very people to rise in arms among us and to purchase that liberty of which he has deprived them, and murdering the people upon whom he has also obtruded them.
Bad King George III. He's the source of slavery. Oh, well, the source of slavery.
Jefferson wrote that?
Correct. He originally wrote that. That's originally part of the Declaration of Independence. It was taken out. Can you see why? Okay. 1781. Notes on the State of Virginia. Jefferson becomes the first prominent American to suggest that Africans are innately inferior. I advance it, therefore, as a suspicion only, that blacks are inferior to whites in the endowment of body and mind. And he, of course, was seen as a very rational, scientific, highly respected person. And that respect helps to further this idea that blacks are inferior. Science enters the picture pretty soon here. I know it's kind of small, but can someone do this?
The Constitution is signed defining African-American males as 3/5 of a man and not mentioning indigenous peoples at all. It's during this period that the scientific community in Europe is creating the OIS, a race theory relying heavily upon craniometry measurement of the brain skull to develop 4 distinct races. The science claims that the larger the brain, the higher the intelligence. Those with the largest brains and thus the smartest are Caucasoids, where our racial designation of Caucasian comes from. Next is the Mongoloid, referencing yellow people as those of Asian descent. Australoid, signifying red or brown people. And Negroid, the lowest and the only category without any geographic location.
Now, isn't it obvious that the larger the cranium, the smarter you are, and the smaller, the less capable you are. Isn't it obvious? You know, the 3/5 compromise in our Constitution was set up as a compromise, of course, to work out the issue of representation and that kind of thing. Ladies and gentlemen, if you had never heard a teacher say this before, our founding documents are racist documents. Declaration of Independence and the Constitution are riddled with racism. Okay. The Naturalization Act specifies that only free white immigrants are eligible for citizenship. The Act expressly denies the right to vote or own land from Asia, the Caribbean, Central or South America, and Africa. Indigenous peoples become citizens through individual treaties or intermarriage. So our first Immigration Act was in 1790, the Naturalization Act. We will see this act come up over and over and over in various forms to limit certain people and allow certain people to come in. Until 1965, I think that was a great year, personally. But there were various manifestations of this of this Naturalization Act that kept certain people in and certain people out. We'll see how that plays out. Here are some of those points along the timeline. 2 to 14 years of residency were required in various acts that were passed in those years to become a citizen. 1855, white women's citizenship was tied to the husband's citizenship. 1870, naturalization only opened to African-born and descendants of Africans, not to citizens of this country. I know what you're thinking. Honey, you're thinking 14th Amendment, aren't you? Like, you're born here, you're a citizen here? Well, I guess not. Chinese immigrants excluded, of course, in the famous Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882. Women's citizenship can be revoked. 1907, federal law. 1922, Japanese immigrants excluded. 1965, immigrant quotas based on race abolished. And if you could possibly believe it, recently, some immigrant veterans are barred from citizenship. What comes around continues to go around.
Yeah.
All right. 1830.
Oh, before you get there, one question. That just brought something to mind. Is a great deal of the people who consider themselves to be conservative in their political views tend to be also very literal constitutionists.
Yeah, literal constructionists.
Constructionists, okay.
Mm-hmm.
They take the Constitution as its literal meaning instead of the great document.
Literalism? Oh, my goodness.
I'm seeing a relationship here.
Great connection. I do also want to make mention of the fact that 8 people who signed the Declaration of Independence were immigrants, not born in this country. 1830. White settlers claim more and more land. Of course, this is a picture of the Trail of Tears during Andrew Jackson's administration. Gold is discovered in the heart of Cherokee country. The Indian Removal Act mandates the removal of indigenous people east of the Mississippi River to Oklahoma, and it was one of the, I'm going to be careful about my language here, I'm not going to say darkest, I'm not going to say blackest, I'm going to say saddest moments in U.S. history, if there is any one moment in U.S. history. Over 30,000 people died during this forced migration from parts of the South East to what is now Oklahoma, the long walk where they cried, more commonly known as the Trail of Tears. Hitler used this as a model for his own extermination of a certain group of people. Thought this was a great idea. All right, a reader, please.
The American Anti-Slavery Society forms in Philadelphia, 1833. By 1835, hundreds of branches exist throughout the free states, and anti-slavery sentiment is on the rise. But as attacks on slavery grow, so do arguments defending it. Slavery advocates turn to scientific and biblical arguments to prove that Negroes are distinct and inferior to whites. Slavery is no longer described as a necessary evil, but as a positive good. The rationale is so strong that when slavery is finally abolished in 1865, the racial idea lives on.
We will see exactly how. This is an interesting one, just to summarize this one. I'm a Presbyterian, I'll just admit that. And the Presbyterian came up with the idea that, you remember Abraham, Noah and his sons, he had some kids, and it was the story of Ham in Genesis, who is one of a series of the biblical justifications for slavery. Well, it was Ham, apparently, who came from Africa, according to this Presbyterian. Ham sees his father Noah drunk and naked. Ham is cursed by Noah to be a servant of servants. Ham's descendants, Reverend Palmer explains, are turned dark by the curse. Conservative Christians and segregationists argue that this and other biblical passages prove that slavery is part of God's established order. So Ham is responsible because of the evil act that he did. He was cursed with dark skin color, according to this pastor, and therefore God's plan is for slaves of black people to be equally cursed.
What is the left thing? I can't read it. something, something.
Oh, okay. So this is just, again, the Australasian and the Mongoloid and the different classifications.
So that's Asian, supposedly.
This one here. Look, notice the high forehead.
Yeah.
Oh, high forehead, sorry.
Right.
High
right.
forehead here.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Coming back to my backyard, can someone read this one?
Slavery is declared illegal in the Oregon country, but a lash law is enacted in June 1844, which requires that black men and women in Oregon, be they free or slave, be whipped twice a year until he or she shall quit the territory. It is soon deemed too harsh, and its provisions for punishment are reduced to forced labor in December 1844.
Oregon was the last state to become a state before the Civil War. It was not, you know, in that continual, this is a slave state, we've got to have a non-slave state. This is a slave state, we've got to have a non-slave state. Oregon was in the non-slave state category. But you want to call that a non-slave state? That's what a non-slave state apparently looked like in our neck of the woods. All right. Mexican-American War, very, very important. I want to, in the interest of time, move forward here. How about a reader for this one? Yes, sir.
In the People versus Hall, the California Supreme Court reverses the conviction of a white man for murder, stating that the statements of key Chinese witnesses are inadmissible because no black or mulatto person or Indian shall be allowed to give evidence in favor of or against a white man. The Chief Justice notes that if allowed to testify, the Chinese, an inferior race, would then be eligible for citizenship, voting, and jury duty, which would present a great danger.
Yeah, and of course that was the launching pad for one of the most notorious Supreme Court decisions in the United States. Anybody want to venture to guess what it is? Dred Scott. The U.S. Supreme Court defines enslaved people as property, saying that Congress cannot establish slavery because to do so would interfere with private property rights. They ruled that descendants of slaves are so far inferior that they had no rights which the white man was bound to respect. There's a whole story that goes behind that.
But weren't women property at the same time?
Yeah.
Women, who knows more about this than I do?
Well, women were literally the property of their husbands, the property of their father and then their husband.
Yeah.
So that's the giving away of the way, like your father gives you to the man because your property passed on to the next.
Okay. Well, and of course, before this, also, this is the time frame in which women's citizenship was tied to their husbands. Whether they were considered property or not of their husbands is another question. They certainly weren't allowed to manage their own property or any kind of property.
And women didn't gain the right to vote until after black men had been allowed to vote.
Correct. Yeah. 1920. We're about to come up on the 100th anniversary. All right. 1862. Homestead Act makes 15 million acres available. At low cost to white working class homesteaders. Okay, so you've got an influx of white people that are invited to come out to the West Coast in droves. 85 million acres of indigenous lands have been sold to European homesteaders by 1862. Of course, this is the period of time when westward migration started to trickle in about the 1840 time period, ended around 1880 or so. This is right in the middle of that time frame. Of course, the Civil War is going on at this time, too. All right, Amendment 13, many former slaves become sharecroppers. A previous slide said that while the actual chattel slavery ended, the idea of race continues on and manifests itself in various forms. And that's the thing about racism. It tries to hide. It tries not to be obvious, but so it changes form. It's shape-shifting. And so even up to this very day, we have another manifestation of subjugation that takes place after chattel slavery is done with. Sharecropping is a system in which a person who doesn't own land goes to a person with land and says, can I farm your land? And the person says, yes, okay. Usually, the person is paid not in money, but in cotton or whatever is grown off the land, which is worth significantly less if you were to try to pay for something in a store. So black people, A, don't have land.
And they need things, they need seeds and that kind of thing to buy, but they're forced because they're paid in cotton or whatever commodity is grown off the land. They go to the store, they say, well, can you give me some cheese, not cheese, but can you give me some cornmeal and some rice to eat? And the person will say, okay, well, that's worth about $1.65. Person from with money comes into the store, buys the same thing. Money is worth $2.50. So African Americans only sharecropping are only given are given a much less for what the kind of currency that they have. It's like a double whammy.
Well,
yeah.
The other thing is because African Americans could, or you know, the sharecroppers couldn't read or numbers or anything, they would go at the end of the year to collect, you know, to balance their books with the tenant, the farmer who owned all the property. And they would all, you know, there were a few honest ones who would maybe give them a little bit of money at the end of the year. But mostly, they would either break even and get no money, or they would say, oh, you still owe a bunch. And that just kept them inevitably, they were never out of debt. And they were, and the farmers, the majority of them, were just making it up. You know, they were just doing whatever they could do to keep them in slavery, kind of, although they weren't even with necessarily what we were actually.
It's a system called debt peonage, debt slavery. Mm-hmm. It's exactly what it is. You've hit the nail on the head. Yes.
And I think another shape-shifting aspect of it is even though slavery was abolished in the 13th Amendment, there was a provision in the amendment that said unless you couldn't make someone work for nothing, unless they were convicted of a crime
right.
and were in prison, and then you know, work the hell out.
That's the loophole.
And that's the new slavery.
Mm-hmm.
Back then.
Precisely.
They went around
thank
you know, putting people in prison for nothing.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah,
trumped up charges, just give them a,
yeah.
have them go into jail, and then you can justify anything. Because the Constitution says, 13th Amendment says, unless this situation. Thank you. All right. 1872, California school code states that every school must be open for the admission of white, all white children, making no provision for the education of Asian Americans, Mexican Americans, African Americans, and indigenous children. And this is the period, of course, called Reconstruction, which was an abysmal failure. Certainly for people of color. All right, this just tells more about it. This is all about creating a school for Native Americans, killing the Indian but saving the child, and trying to Europeanize the child in order to become, to be able to fit into society culturally. If you can't change the skin color, at least you can try to make them culturally white. Okay. Weird. Is it too small?
During the period between Reconstruction and World War II, nearly 4,000 African Americans were killed in lynchings across 12 southern states. This is not frontier justice carried out by a few marginalized vigilantes or extremists. Many African Americans who were never accused of any crime are tortured and murdered in front of picnicking spectators, including elected officials and prominent citizens. For bumping into a white person wearing their military uniforms after World War I, or not using the appropriate title when addressing a white person, among other reasons. People who participate in lynchings act with impunity and are even celebrated. Not a single white person is convicted of murder for lynching a black person in America during this period.
This is a period in history, if you want to put a name to it, called the Nadir, N-A-D-I-R, Nadir. It's the most horrific period of time, possibly even with the inclusion of chattel slavery for African Americans in our nation, in which they aren't seen as valuable at all, at least as slaves. They were valued, and you tried not to injure your property, but when you have no reason to save yourself, and you have no value whatsoever, you are screwed. There are some historians who put 1901 as the most horrific, absolute lowest year of violence and dehumanization for people of color. And we're not just talking about African Americans, we're talking about Chinese Americans and any other non-European. This, by the way, you can imagine. You don't have to imagine. Okay. Chinese Exclusion Act, I mentioned before. African Americans certainly weren't the only people who were discriminated against. Of course, 1896 was the famous Plessy versus Ferguson Supreme Court law, in which one Supreme Court justice dissented, but eight of them consented.
which of course declared separate but equal status for all services given to blacks and whites. But they were certainly separate, but far from equal as time went on during the period that begins at this time, which we call Jim Crow. Jim Crow continues until for many, many decades into the 1950s. Possibly even still. Texas court rules that Mexican Americans are not white. In California, Mexican Americans are classified as Caucasian in 1930 when the Attorney General classifies them as Indians, which leads to their segregation. So the funny thing about this is that Mexican Americans are considered white enough to fight, to get employment during World War II. But then when the need for labor is over, then they get classified as another color. So in our U.S. Census. Okay. 1905. I'm going to go a little bit more into Dr. Du Bois and the Niagara Movement tomorrow, just briefly. I do want to just kind of bring up these two gentlemen, Booker T. Washington and W.E.B. Du Bois. Very interesting dialogue, polemic between them, and different ways to solve the race problem, if you will. I'll go into this a little bit more tomorrow. Okay. 1910, having decreed in 1866 that any person with a quarter or more Negro blood should be considered a colored person, the state of Virginia changes the percentage to 1/16 in 1910. Thus, the arbitrary construction of race by the U.S. government continues. 1/16, and you're black. All right. Again, I'm going to skip over some of these slides in the interest of time. Okay, let's talk about Oregon again. How about another reader?
The Oregon State Legislature passes a number of restrictive laws. The alien land law prevents first-generation Japanese Americans from owning or leasing land. The Oregon business restriction law allows cities to refuse business licenses to first-generation Japanese Americans.
Mm-hmm. There are pictures I've seen of the KKK marching right down the middle in the Rose Parade in Oregon, in Portland, right down the middle of Main Street, right next to the mayor. It's a picture, actually, I've seen of the mayor in 1922. If the KKK wasn't strong in the South, I can tell you where it was strong. Picture of the mayor, the city council, KKK in full dress. Right. U.S. government, of course, in 1929 deports thousands of Mexicans, including U.S. citizens, to Mexico during the Great Depression. Another very sad moment in our history, of course, we are in war against the Japanese, among others, and we deport Japanese Americans to internment camps throughout the western part of the United States. Keep them there for years. And take their property, because, of course, they're not going to need it again. I have not yet apologized for that. The U.S. government has not, I believe, laid an apology for that. GI Bill works wonderfully for returning GIs from World War II, if you're white. But again, if you don't fall into that category, you don't get much out of the GI Bill. It's really not for you. Non-whites need not apply. Actually, the idea that whiteness is not superior was formulated by this man right here. Scientific community realized it finally, but it didn't really filter into the minds of the general population, maybe even until now. Okay, this is about Brown versus Board of Education, and effectively ends Plessy versus Ferguson after 58 years of separate versus equal, and effectively ends the Jim Crow, technically Jim Crow period. Oh, how many teachers of African descent did you have growing up? Okay, let's just do this. How many teachers of African descent did you have growing up? Let's say finish high school. So an interesting... Thank you. I think I may have had one. The interesting fallout of this Supreme Court decision was that Now we can teach all kids. Kids have to be taught together. And so we got to send black kids to white schools, white kids to black schools. But a whole lot of parents said, I'm not having my son or daughter taught by a black teacher. And so black teachers were basically told, you are not invited to teach my child. So the pillar of being an African-American teacher, the status that existed in the African-American community was lost because so many African-American teachers did not even try to become teachers because they knew they wouldn't be hired anyway. So, great idea, but the follow-up implications were problematic. Yeah.
Around this time, have you heard of Lake No Negro?
Yeah.
Oh, go ahead.
Lake?
It's called Lake Oswego.
Oh.
And around, this was about the time when they said you can't do this redlining there anymore.
Yeah. Area around Portland. Yes.
Yeah, one of the things, not just that basically all the black teachers were given their pink slips because, you know, it was just white teachers kept on, but so the black kids lost their role models for it's good to be learning and, you know, all this stuff and be smart. But they were sent into classrooms with teachers who hated them. You know, like white teachers did not want black kids in their school. I mean, it was terrible for them. You know, so it was a double problem.
Exactly. All right, I'm going to do a little skipping ahead here, but I do want to, this one here, 1980, building on President Nixon's war on drugs, the Reagan-Bush-Clinton administrations expand this war. Ladies and gentlemen, when you hear war on drugs, war on crime, think war on black people. Because drugs are no more prominent in black communities than they are in any other community. But you never much hear about a drug raid in a nice white suburb. Now, do you? And that's probably because if you have a drug raid on a nice white neighborhood, you're going to hear from somebody who is in a powerful position. Who are the easiest people to target and say, we're doing our job. We're going hard on crime. We're doing what we need to do. We're putting people in jail for crimes. Where's the easiest place? Where's the go-to place? All right. This is just outlines what I'm calling the prison industrial complex, the building of prisons, indicating that just approximately 5 million, including those on probation and parole, are currently in prison now, up from a couple hundred thousand in the 1970s. The number of people in prison is astronomical now in relation, all because of the war, a supposedly war on crime. And black people are primarily targeted. I've laid out, it's on the wall over there someplace, but the parallels between the debt peonage system that existed right after the Civil War and the prison industrial complex. I'm not going to go into that compare contrast right now. I'll just invite you to look at it. It's actually right over there on the wall, right over there. Interesting implications and connections. 2001, September 11th, of course, sets the stage for anti-Muslim sentiment, if it didn't exist before, which it certainly did. Did you know that on the U.S. Census, you are considered white if you are from North Africa and Middle Eastern? You are white. So what's that about? Okay, 2008, as a result of subprime mortgage lending crisis, the total loss of wealth for people of color was between $164 and $213 billion over 8 years, perhaps the greatest loss of wealth for people of color in modern U.S. history, just a few years ago. 2010, Arizona passes anti-immigration laws.
Wow.
I'll let you read it on the wall there. Trayvon Martin and many, 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 many others. Fatally shot by George Zimmerman, a neighborhood watch volunteer. I think over there I've got the list, and it's such a small list, of those driving while black, or lights out, rear tail light out while black, or whatever. All right. Supreme Court strikes down the provision of the Voting Rights Act of 65 that required certain states and local governments to obtain federal approval where implementing any changes to their voting laws or practices. This provision exists to address entrenched racial discrimination in voting. Since the ruling, several states have passed laws that restrict or eliminate online voting registration, early voting, same-day registration, and pre-registration for teens about to turn 18. The ruling also has resulted in several states implementing stringent voter identification laws, like eliminating hundreds of polling places, undermining the right to vote for hundreds of thousands of U.S. citizens. I don't have to tell you what kind of citizens we don't want to have voting in our country. You know, recite the preamble to the Constitution, or the whole Constitution itself, and then we'll let you vote. 2015. Anybody recognize that guy? I'm not going to go into it. After being offered a job as customer service, this woman was actually told, you can't have dreadlocks in our workplace. And the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals dismisses the lawsuit that tries to say it's okay to have dreadlocks in the workplace. But she apparently got fired because of her dreadlocks.
The U.S. military is finally allowing forms of hair that they wouldn't allow before.
Other than this. Well, all right, we're waking up. At the Alzheimer's Association International Conference in London in July, researchers reported that harsh life experiences appear to leave African Americans particularly vulnerable to Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia. This has health implications. This has life longevity implications for people of color who have higher stress in their lives due to racism in the United States. Of course, you remember this incident.
Yep.
Rashawn Nelson and Dante Robinson walk into a Philadelphia Starbucks for a meeting with a friend. 2 minutes later, the manager calls 911. Police arrive moments later and arrest the two men. Police did not explain why they were being arrested. They were not read the Miranda rights. I guess they didn't need to be read the Miranda rights. They were clearly guilty.
They weren't being questioned. You don't need to read Miranda rights unless you question them. So you don't need to. There's no reason to read the Miranda rights.
There you go. Well, I've just overwhelmed you, if you didn't already know some of these things. This is kind of the hard day to slog through. This is a short, but I think at least covers the main points along the racial journey and the creation of racism and the creation of race. Let's end in prayer. Gracious and loving God, we live in a racist system. We benefit, those of us with light skin color, with a certain culture. We benefit from it. Please forgive us. Help us to do what we can to make a change. In Christ's name, amen.
Amen.